You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is episode 90, covering the week of September 18th through September 22nd, 2017. I am Brian McClanahan, your host, and it's good to have you back on the program. Before we get started, all the usual housekeeping. If you do like this podcast, please share it around on social media. You can do so. You can find us on Facebook at Abbeville Institute, on Twitter at Abbeville INST, and of course, you can subscribe to our YouTube page. I just look for Abbeville Institute. If you don't want to go out there and search for all those things, you can go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll find all our social media buttons. Also, you'll find our Amazon Smile button. So if you go and shop at Amazon, you'll be giving us a little change as well every time you purchase something there. Also on our webpage, if you give us an email address, we'll give you Kirkpatrick Sales Emancipation Hell for free, and you will get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday, along with our weekend email, the Week in Review, either Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast. Also, remember that we exist on your generous contributions alone. If you do like what we do at the Abbeville Institute and you want to support our mission to explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition, please consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the Institute. It will help us keep the lights on, help keep the podcast going, help keep the website up, and of course, help us deliver high-quality programs to you. All the stuff we have on the website is free. Over 200 lectures. All the articles were over 1,000 now. All of that material is free. So you giving us a little bit of change here and there helps keep all that stuff free for the general public. Okay, so let's talk about the material we had this week and a lot of interesting stuff. And in fact, I want to start with something that wasn't on the website. It was something that that Clyde Wilson actually sent me. It was a New York Times opinion piece by David Brooks. And David Brooks... And this fits into the material this week, which is why I'm bringing this up. David Brooks was talking about Sam Francis and how, and Pat Buchanan, and how they were predicting the Trump phenomenon back in the early 1990s, in the late 1980s, and how Brooks had met Sam Francis and thought he was this kind of strange, centric kind of guy, but he realized that he's realized recently that Trump isn't a one-time spinoff, that there could be something more to this, that Trumpism is something deeper than just we want to drain the swamp, or some of the surface issues that people think Republican voters were attracted to Trump over. What he realized is that this is deeper, this is cultural, and Sam Francis had told Pat Buchanan, don't call yourself a conservative, call yourself anything but that. And he was looking at various skirmishes that were underlying the political conflicts of the time and undergirding them. And he talked about religion versus secular, nationalist versus globalist. All these things are merging into a larger political movement. And when you look at some of the material we talk about this week, essentially that's what some of the columnists are getting at. That the South and the Southern tradition, the reason it's so people are attacking it so much is because it does represent that. It represents that important tradition, not conservatism, but a tradition in America. And to demonize it is to undermine that particular tradition. And so even when we talk about the Constitution or, we talk about... agriculture, we talk about economics, we talk about anything, we talk about just general politics, that's the case. I mean, the thing is, what are we looking to conserve if we're talking about being a conservative, or what parts of the Southern tradition should we think are valuable moving forward? And unfortunately, we have an entire movement popping up now that's trying to demonize everything about the South, but it's not just about the South, it's about the entire American tradition. And as I've said on this podcast several times, the South is America. You can't get around the fact that the South is the entity that helped found America. I mean, we don't have the Declaration of Independence without the South. We don't have the Constitution without the South. Now, the Declaration is not a founding document. It's actually a defounding document. But it does set out the principle of self-determination. And so that, when you look at the war in 1861, of course, that's self-determination. Somebody asked me the other day on social media, or it might have been an email, and I'll probably address this in my own podcast at one point, but you know, okay, we can look at the 13 British North American colonies and say, yeah, they were able to gain their independence, but what about all the other territory? And this is an argument that's often made against secession. What about all the other territory? You know, the United States purchased Florida, and they purchased the Louisiana Purchase, and they purchased the Mexican Cession. And so all that territory, how can we say that that territory can then become independent? Shouldn't they have to buy that stuff back from the United States? Well, the key is, of course, if you follow that line of thinking, then the 13 British North American colonies should never have been able to be independent because that was British territory, and they should have had to buy it from the British. The idea of secession is a self-determination. It's not about the boundaries of a state. It's about the people in those boundaries saying, you know what, we want to be independent from you for whatever reason. And so that's what you have to understand about secession. And as I said, maybe I'll talk about that on my own podcast at some point. But this little piece by David Brooks, who's a leftist, he's recognizing that, and he's disparaging. It's not like this piece is laudatory of Sam Francis or Pat Buchanan or anything else or Trump. But the thing is, Brooks recognizes that there's something bigger going on here. The mainstream kind of neoconservatism, which is all about business and taxes, isn't working. And this is why the Republican Party is getting so confused about what it's doing, because the base of the Republican Party has moved beyond business and taxes. They realize there is a substantial culture war taking place in the United States. That's why monuments are being attacked. It is not just about the South and its symbols. It's about American civilization. It's about Western civilization. There's a school, I think it was in Pennsylvania, that the students there, the college students, decided that the Western civilization course was too European. It's a Western civilization course. So this is the thing. There is a major culture war taking place, and everything that's going on in society right now can be looked at through that lens. And I think people are starting to finally wake up and realize it. What is under attack is Western civilization, Christianity. The South is a low-hanging fruit. They're going to pick that fruit off, and then they're going to come after everything else. This is why Jefferson's statue was attacked at UVA of all places. And so what can we do? Well, I mean, it's easy to say, well, we got to go out there and fight about these statues. And yeah, I mean, to try to keep these things up and try to use every legal means necessary to do it. And to be active in opposing this kind of stuff. But the other thing that has to happen is we really need to think about our own communities. And I use the phrase, think locally, act locally. This is what needs to happen. You need to start making sure that your back door is in order, that you've got your family in order, that you're trying to exert some influence on your local community, and forget about what happens in California or Vermont or somewhere else. That's not going to matter in the long run, because what matters is in your own backyard. And I think that's where Southerners were prescient in that. They were just concerned about what was happening to them at the time in their backyard. And when there was an alien force being exerted on that, or at least potential of one, that's where they got reflexive or reactive or whatever you want to call it, and they started resisting. And I mean, this is typical and prototypical self-determination. Don't tell me what I have to do. So let's look at some of the articles for this particular week. And we start with the piece on Monday, which was entitled Comparing Constitutions by James David Altman. It's a comparison of the U.S. and the Confederate Constitution. And being that September 17th is theoretically Constitution Day, this was published on September 18th in honor of Constitution Day. In order to understand American constitutionalism, we can't just look at the Constitution for the United States. We should also look at all the state constitutions, the Articles of Confederation, and the Confederate Constitution, because what a lot of people don't realize, it is part, it's an expression of American constitutional thought. And so this is a very nice little essay comparing the two. And of course, the knee-jerk reaction, everyone says, well, just look, here it is, this Constitution, the only difference is slavery, everything else is the same, it's an exact copy. Well, it's not, and anyone that says that hasn't ever read it. The one thing, when people talk about the only difference is slavery, there isn't really a whole lot of difference in that particular issue. The Confederate Constitution made it clear that the central authority could not abolish slavery. The fact is, though, the U.S. Constitution, it was clear that the central authority could not abolish slavery there either. It just wasn't expressly stated. But that was an understood limiting power of the document itself, because if it didn't list in that particular document that the Congress could do it, they couldn't do it. That's how the Constitution was sold to the states. So both constitutions were the same in that way. It's just that one expressly stated it and the other one didn't. And I've had people say, it says slavery right here. That's true, because what was happening is, again, the Confederate Constitution was expressly stating what they considered to be a problem, a defect of the U.S. Constitution, that things weren't spelled out enough. That gave you implied powers. So what the Confederate Constitution was trying to do was eliminate implied powers all through the document. You find that, whether it's a lack of authority for federally funded internal improvements, lack of authority for protective tariffs, lack of authority for the idea that you can have appropriations for anything that doesn't have specific purposes listed for it. I mean, we call these things earmarks. You got to say what you're going to spend the money on. I mean, it goes across the board. So the Confederate Constitution, the innovations in it were that they took the problems that we're experiencing under the U.S. Constitution and made sure they weren't in this document. And some people have said, well, the Confederate Constitution still contains the Supremacy Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause. Yeah, it does. It those things aren't going to hurt if you spelled out what the government cannot do in more detail. That was always the problem with the originalist argument. And originalism, of course, says that it's how the Constitution was interpreted at the time of ratification. And that was, and this is what James Wilson of Pennsylvania said, everything that it doesn't say we can't do, we can only do what it says we can do. That's the exact opposite of the states, where the states can do everything they want, as long as it doesn't say we can't do it. So the point is, what this Constitution is an expression of originalism, and to look at this is to understand that, you know, the presidency, for example, gets a 6-year non-renewable term. That way, you take the factions out of, you know, clamoring for the spoils, theoretically, which is what Calhoun was so worried about in the Disquisition. So, you eliminate that problem. The president also has a line item veto to cut, pork barrel legislation. Pork. To get rid of that. So this Constitution is interesting. It prohibited the slave trade, the international slave trade outside of the United States. It did say that, of course, one of the issues was if they acquired territory, that territory would be open to slavery, which was one of the major issues of the sectional conflict and the expansion of slavery into the territories. But on the other hand, it did not say that the states couldn't abolish slavery, and it didn't say that free states couldn't be admitted. They perfectly believed that at one point, maybe some of these northern states would join the Confederate States of America. So that was perfectly acceptable. So this particular Constitution is interesting. Put side by side, there's a lot of similarities, and even in the powers that are supposed to be there and not supposed to be there. So I think that if we talk about American constitutionalism, we have to look at both in that particular way. Where are the similarities and differences? And is it just slavery? Of course it's not. In fact, I think you could argue that they're almost identical in terms of slavery. It's just that the Confederate Constitution used the word slaves and made sure that the issue was not left open and ambiguous. Whereas because it was open and ambiguous, if you look at an original argument for the U.S. Constitution, it should have never been an issue. That should have never been a problem. Open and ambiguous didn't mean anything, because open and ambiguous simply meant that the Congress couldn't do it. But that's unfortunately, people don't realize that argument because they don't understand what originalism actually is. All right, so on Tuesday we ran a piece by Clyde Wilson, a book review of yours truly. My newest book came out Monday, How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America. So it's fitting that, of course, this comes out during the Constitution Week. And Clyde does a very nice job here. It's a very nice review explaining what the problem is with Hamilton. And Constitution Day, Hamilton was doing his best to undermine the Constitution that he argued for. If you look at Hamilton and the Federalist Essays, That Hamilton is completely different than the Hamilton as Secretary of Treasury, and of course the Hamilton in 1787 in Philadelphia when he's arguing for an elected king and senators for life and the reduction of the states to corporate powers. But of course, you know, that Hamilton, nobody really talks about. They talk about the Hamilton in the musical, and they think that we live in Hamilton's America and we're happy with this massive bureaucratic state with central banking and all the things that's done to us. So see, this actually gets to the heart of what, when we talk about the next three pieces, what's happened to America. Hamilton's America is the antithesis of the corporate, Hamilton's America is the antithesis of what the Trumpsters really want, the Trumpites. What he favors, Hamilton's America is corporate America. It is a fusion of banking and finance. It is the neoconservative view of America. That's Hamilton's America. And what people don't realize is that by, you know, and of course Trump has a portrait of Hamilton in the Oval Office. I mean, Trump is kind of a Hamiltonian. I don't think that he's anything but. But the thing is, the people that support him are not. They're looking at America and they're seeing blue-collar jobs being lost. They're seeing a cultural war. They're seeing everything they love torn down. These are real Americans, and they don't like this idea that Hamilton's America is destroying it. The reduction of the states can't do anything. They can't block any legislation anymore that's even unconstitutional. They can't do any of this stuff. So to them, this cultural war is real, and Hamilton is at the basis of all of that. And I point that out in the book. By going through Hamilton's constitutional machinations and then also bringing in people like John Marshall and Joseph Story and Hugo Black, and how Black's idea of incorporation of the in the 14th Amendment, meaning that the Bill of Rights have to be applied to the states, that does everything to destroy any type of cultural resistance to the central authority. Because now the federal courts just step in and say, well, you can't do that. And of course, no matter what it is, no matter what social issue we're talking about here, now the states can't do anything because they have to have approval from their federal overlords in black robes. So the whole point of that book was to ensure that we have a vision of Hamilton that's in line with what he really did to America, which was give us this implied powers nonsense. It led to expansive federal power, central banking, all the things, the crony capitalism, all the things of foreign adventurism that we don't care for, and that are against the general core principles of the founding generation. I mean, I know Hamilton was part of that group, but he was a nationalist and he was in the minority, without a doubt. Hamilton was in the minority in 1787. And 1788. It's just that once he became Secretary of Treasury, and of course by default he thought he was de facto Prime Minister, and he had Washington's ear. That changed a lot of things. And so, admiring Hamilton is a dangerous thing because it gets you the neoconservatives, it gets you this national greatness conservatism, or it gets you the big government people on the left. And so we have to be very careful of that. And so, thinking about that. When you look at Boyd Cathy's piece on Wednesday, The Historical Folly of Nothing But Race, again, this is the idea that you can take an issue like race and say, all right, everything has to be viewed through the lens of race. All Southerners, all they cared about all the time was race. That was it. And he says this is doing the South a tremendous disservice because there were some real statesmen who were concerned about things other than race. He actually had a very interesting paragraph in this particular piece. First, he says, yet it would be a major mistake to see race as the only causative factor in this process. Indeed, although racial issues certainly existed, larger questions of social, economic, and cultural dislocation, the breakup of community, and above all, the legitimate, well-grounded fear of the loss of local and individual liberties as the federal government assumed more power and more direct authority over how individuals and families ran their own lives. Figured, if not so visibly, even more significantly. This is exactly what David Brooks was saying, that Sam Francis was talking about. There was something bigger than just race. There were other things going on here. And then he points out something he found as a Jefferson Fellow, a grad student at the University of Virginia, when he was doing some research. He said while he was researching the North Carolina Constitutional Convention of 1835, he expected to find concentration on slavery and the need to defend at all costs the peculiar institution. But he said, quote, "But rather I discovered that free blacks with property freeholders had voted in North Carolina prior to that year and since the Revolution, and that during the lengthy convention debates, most of the state's prominent conservatives, both Democrats and Whigs, defended the suffrage of propertied free blacks. Such notables as State Chief Justice William Gaston, Judge Joseph Daniel, and Secretary of the Navy John Branch under President Jackson all opposed the change. For these leaders, the issue was not so much about race as it was about class and whether a male elector had the property qualification and thus the stability and social and economic status within the community to exercise the franchise." And so Boyd goes on to say, "Since then, in reading about secession and about slavery as the cause of the war between the states, about the strange career of Jim Crow, about the history of the nation's two major political parties, and the essentially ideological uses to which the fractured and tendentious template of race and slavery has been put, it is apparent that such an approach is fraught with problems." Yeah, because when you apply this, it's race and only race. That plays right into the neoconservatives, because that allows you to take out that element of conservatism, which is so vital to American conservatism, which again is the South. This is what Brooks is pointing out. This is what Sam Francis is pointing out. This is what Pat Buchanan is pointing out. This is why people support Trump, because they understand the cultural war. Don Livingston and I have had conversations about this several times, and he says, you know, Americans are more fractured now than ever before about culture. 100 years ago, there was still general consensus on culture. Even 60 years ago, you still had general consensus on culture, but no longer. You now have a very fractured United States in terms of culture. This is a cultural war. It's what Buchanan pointed out in the 1990s, and it is what is going on today when you're looking at all the attacks on traditional America. So Boyd, I think, does a nice job in pointing that out. And of course, on Thursday, we ran a piece by Jerry Salyer entitled "Terrorism, Chivalry, and the Great Compromise." And his position is that the Great Compromise, which is what Shelby Foote called an unspoken understanding which supplemented the formal peace treaty signed by the opposing generals at Appomattox, the idea was that Southerners would accept the reality of their defeat and render full dutiful service to the Union, especially in the military, even as Northerners agreed to honor Southern heroes and admitted that Southern culture and principles had made valuable contributions to America's development. So he says that's over. The Great Compromise no longer holds. And he blames the neoconservatives, because now we have good guys in blue versus bad guys in gray. And anyone who rejects such comic book interpretations of history must be a relativist. But he says, "Yet Northerners of goodwill might well ask themselves whether this wholesale repudiation of the South by American elites has not wrought considerable damage upon America as a whole. That rejection of Southern values, like honor, biblical tradition, forms and courtesy, and deference towards the female sex and its unique role in sustaining civilization, have not created all kinds of problems. That these large-scale rejection of Southern political ideas, like states' rights and decentralization, rurally rooted republicanism, modest and constitutionally restrained government, have transformed American politics in what could be best described as a cold civil war." That's exactly right. Eugene Genovese, he points out, recognized that the scoffing at the South, the belittling of the South, was doing tremendous damage to America. People like John F. Kennedy knew it. That's why they could stand in front of a Confederate flag and make a speech, because they understood that the Southern political and cultural tradition still mattered. Kennedy from Massachusetts, he wasn't, I mean, look, he was trying to get votes, but on the other hand, Kennedy was a realist. That's why he called John C. Calhoun one of the greatest statesmen in the Senate. But no longer is that going on. No longer is any of that there. Because we're in a major cultural war. and it's going to destroy the United States. Without question, it's going to destroy the United States. This cultural war is going to consume everything. I mean, we're seeing it on a regular basis. And this is exactly what Salyer's pointing out. This is exactly what Boyd Cathy is pointing out. It's exactly what David Brooks is understanding. But again, the Republican Party, which has never been for the South, which has really never been anything traditional, is tearing it apart. Essentially, what we have, if you're a traditional American, and I agree with Francis, don't call yourself a conservative anymore. I mean, you could say maybe you're a paleo-conservative, but if you're a traditional American, and why I've used the term, I've actually called myself an American traditionalist. If you're a traditional American, well, the party doesn't fit. No party fits. You don't have one. You don't have the Republican Party isn't your party. The Democrat Party is not your party, because both those parties are nationalist parties. They both generally believe in the mainstream political thought. You can't step outside a very narrow view of politics or society, or you're just cast out for whatever reason. And so, you know, there isn't really a party representing traditional America anymore. And again, we can say that in what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition is those things that Jerry Salyer just brought up. Honor, frugality, gallantry towards women, a fiscal restraint in government, states' rights, decentralization, all of these things that are very much part, the valuable parts of the Southern tradition, which by default was in many ways the American tradition, all of these valuable things now we can't have because they're just considered to be dangerous or, alien to American values. They are American values. But Hamilton's America won out, and so all those things go away. And we conclude the week with a piece entitled, What's Happened to the Southern Heartland? This piece was actually written in 1987 by the late Anthony Harrigan. And he's talking about the disappearance of small farms and what that's going to do to America. He says, quote, the American people have a cultural stake in rural America and its values. Again, this is flyover country. This is the core of Trump, the Trump movement. The agrarian society means something. This is why people are saying enough. We're concerned about real America disappearing. So where do you start? You have to start taking a stand somewhere. People that are taking a stand with Confederate statues understand that it's not going to stop with those. They're going to go after Jefferson and Washington and they're going after Ben Franklin High School at one point. I mean, Ben Franklin. But this thing has been going as a slow march. It began in the 80s. Even before that, really began in the 60s, and then really picked up steam, though, in the 1990s, I think. That's when you started seeing political correctness become so prevalent, and then those people that were taught that are teaching now other people, and so it's an exponential, catastrophic, steamrolling effect that we're seeing. But this is why the Abbeville Institute is so important, because we are standing at the breach. We're standing here and saying, you know, support us because we run pieces like this. We're here to defend that Southern tradition, what is true and valuable in it, to explore it so that people know it. With this podcast, with our website and all the things that we do, our conferences, we hope it's not just about symbols. It's about there's something deeper than that. The symbols represent something else, and that's that American tradition of decentralization, of all the things, you know, Southern manners, Southern music, Southern food. I mean, these things are all represented by these symbols. But of course, the other side doesn't want to have that narrative. They want to tear those things down and take them apart because they understand that. As I wrote in a piece a couple of years ago now on the website, they're about defiance to that central authority telling people what to do. And people all over the world recognize that. This is why you'll see the battle flag in Europe when there's statements against central authority. They're flying. Or in China, you saw it at Tiananmen Square in 1989. There were reports that Chinese students were flying the Confederate battle flag because they recognized that as a symbol of defiance. Defiance. For whatever reason, you're offering your defiance of the center and of your overlords, and you're making a statement, I am not going to be coerced. I am practicing and expressing my self-determination. So, And of course, the cross of St. Andrew, the Scottish cross of St. Andrew, again, a symbol of defiance, and that's what that battle flag has in it. And I think that, you know, we need to recognize that for what it is. But this cultural war is what we're really facing today. It's deeper than just a statue or a flag. It is a cultural war. And traditional American culture is being torn down across America. And it's not going to stop with Southern symbols. And so that's something we have to recognize. And why we need, again, think locally, act locally, sweep around your own doorstep, understand that it didn't begin in 1861. It began before that in terms of political problems with Hamilton. Look at American constitutionalism as originalism as a real case for federalism, which is important. And then try to make sure that your own family, your own community is invested with this belief in American culture and traditional American society. That's what we have to hang on to. That's really what's at stake here. I'll see you next time. Hope you enjoyed it. Good day.